All right, open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 5. We have preached from this text before. Very important passage of Scripture that I want to call your attention to again today. Matthew chapter 5. This, of course, is the Sermon on the Mount. Let's read, beginning at verse 1. And seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain. And when he was set, his disciples came unto him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying. So, primarily, he's addressing the disciples. The disciples came up to him, and he taught them. Now, I think it's safe to say that Jesus also directed these remarks to the people that were within earshot of him as well. But the disciples were in front of him. They came to him, and he taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." First of all, let me just give you this outline. Verses 3 through 8, Jesus deals with the disciples or the preacher's heart. If he's talking to the disciples, he's talking to Peter, James, and John, and the others. He's talking to the preachers, the men of God, the apostles of the early church. Verses 3 through 8, he's dealing with the preacher's heart. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Humility. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Holy sorrow over sinful conditions, etc. Verse 5, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. These are all the internal heart conditions of the preachers, the disciples that Jesus was addressing. Verses 9 through 16, Jesus shifts the focus to the preacher's public responsibility. Verses 3 through 8, the preacher's heart. Verses 9 through 16, the preacher's public responsibility. Verse 9, blessed are the peacemakers. That is a responsibility of the preacher. For they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt have lost his savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and to be trodden under foot of men. Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the home. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. The preacher's heart, verses 3 through 8, the preacher's public responsibility in verses 9 through 16. Dealing with the latter, Jesus says three things regarding the preacher's public responsibility. Number one, he must be faithful to endure persecution. And if he's a real man of God, persecution will come. If a so-called preacher is not experiencing persecution, it's because he's not a real preacher. A real preacher will suffer persecution. He's to be faithful to endure persecution. Number two, he's to be faithful to preach the salty message. Verse 13, you're the salt of the earth. He's to be faithful to preach the salty message. Number three, he is to be faithful to be the light of Christ, verses 14 through 16, to direct people, of course, to Christ, who is the light of the world. That is the threefold public responsibility that God has given to every preacher of the gospel in this passage of Scripture. I want to do some historical comparisons with you, and I want to bring home a point. I want to talk, first of all, about the great awakenings in colonial America, which began in the 1720s and continued with the second great awakening into the mid-1800s. So from the 1720s to the mid-1800s, colonial America experienced two great spiritual awakenings. What did those awakenings produce in colonial America? What were the results of those great awakenings? First of all, there were many conversions to the Lord Jesus Christ. Secondly, there was great growth among the churches of colonial America. Thirdly, there was a great thirst for liberty. Fourthly, there was courage to fight oppression and tyranny, which was, in fact, our war for independence. And number five, there was the establishment of a Christian society. At the end of our war for independence, the awakenings of New England and colonial America produced a Christian society across the colonies. This was all the result of the Great Awakenings from 1720 to the mid-1800s. Let me go over those again with you. Many, many thousands conversions to Christ. Great growth among the churches. A great thirst for liberty and freedom. Courage to fight oppression and tyranny, the war for independence. The establishment of a Christian society. Benjamin Franklin, one of America's founding fathers, one of America's most influential and most important founding fathers, became good friends with one of the preachers responsible, in part, for the Great Awakenings in colonial America. His name was George Whitefield. They became quite close. Ben Franklin had been approached by many Europeans relative to what it was like to live in America. Remember, Benjamin Franklin is called a deist. And in fact, when you read his autobiography, he calls himself a deist. I will tell you, however, that the definition of a deist in the 1700s was not the definition of a deist in 2020. What's it like, Mr. Franklin, to live in America. So many Europeans wrote Dr. Franklin with that question that he produced a pamphlet that could be readily available to give to people who were thinking about moving to America from Europe. The pamphlet was called Information to Those Who Would Remove to America. That was the title of it. Information to Those Who Would Remove to America. It was intended to be a guide for Europeans who were thinking of relocating in America. In that pamphlet, Benjamin Franklin wrote this: bad examples to youth are more rare in America, which must be comfortable consideration to parents. To this may be truly added that serious religion, under its various denominations, is not only tolerated, but respected and practiced. Atheism is unknown there. Infidelity, rare and secret, so that persons may live to a great age in that country without having their piety shocked by meeting with either an atheist or an infidel. And the divine being seems to have manifested his approbation of the mutual forbearance and kindness with which the different sects treat each other, S-E-C-T-S, treat each other, by the remarkable prosperity with which he has been pleased to favor the whole country. Benjamin Franklin's description of colonial America as a result of the great spiritual awakenings of that time. Bad examples are rare in America for children, for youth. Atheism is unknown. Infidelity, rare. People can live to a great age without ever having met an atheist or an infidel. That is the impact that the Great Awakenings had on society in the colonies during this point in our history. During that period, Christian people looked to their pastors for their spiritual, moral, ethical, social, and yes, political instruction. Are you all awake?
Yes, sir.
I know you lost an hour's sleep last night. Stay with me. During that period, Christian people looked to their pastors for their spiritual, moral, ethical, social, and political instruction. This lasted for at least 125 years. This was at least a 125-year period, the early formative years of our country. I want that fresh in your mind. Have you got it? Four of you got it. Have you got it? Okay. By contrast, during the last 125 years of modern America, our country has experienced phenomenal church growth. Phenomenal church growth over the last 125 years. During this span of time, And under the influence of this dynamic growth of churches in this country, what has happened? Thousands of churches have been planted to the point that there are now over 300,000 evangelical churches in America today. Over 300,000. There are scores of mega churches. Churches with attendances in the thousands and sometimes multiple thousands. Scores of mega churches. Are you following me? I told you about 125 years of colonial history and the Great Awakenings and the result. I'm talking about 125 years of modern church growth. Thousands of churches planted, scores of mega churches, radio preachers by the hundreds, televangelists by the hundreds, Christian schools by the hundreds, colleges and universities by the scores. Unprecedented church growth. Are you hearing me? Thousands of churches planted, scores of mega churches, radio preachers, televangelists, Christian schools and colleges, unprecedented church growth. 125 years of this. What has been the result of this growth? Divorce has decimated America's families. Our entertainment industries have gone into the toilet. Our colleges and universities are hotbeds of atheism and whoredom. Our morals have sunk into a garbage heap. Our political institutions have become purveyors of socialism, warmongering, police state machinations, Orwellian surveillance society, dishonesty, bribery, etc. ad infinitum. Federal deficits and deficit spending explode as much under Republicans as under Democrats. Conservatives and professing Christians are as quick to live off the public dole as liberals and the unchurched. 50%, almost 50% of the American people are living off the government handout, taxpayer handout. That means they are living off the other 50%. Think of what this does to our debt-based economy. Think what this does to the taxpayers who are not on the public dole. We are paying taxes for millions of people who are choosing to suck off the teat of taxpayers' contributions. Trying to be nice, contributions to the federal tax system. And at least, I assure you, at least half of the half who are living on the public dole call themselves Christians. Conservatives and Christians cheer for perpetual war. Professing Christians are as dishonest, hateful, unethical, and mean-spirited as the unchurched. Professing Christians and conservatives are as quick to fall under the protective wing of big government as are liberals and unbelievers. Ladies and gentlemen, we are already in a socialist state. This idea that Republicans, Americans reject socialism. Are you kidding me? They're taking every handout from government that they can get. They're taking every freebie. They're taking every benefit. They're doing everything they can to live off of the taxpayers as people that call themselves liberals. You're fooling yourself if you think the Republican Party is not as socialist as the Democrat Party. They're both socialist parties. Here's the only difference between the economic policies of the Democrats and the Republicans. And when I finish this, you're going to know I'm right. The Democrats want to tax and spend. And the Republicans want to borrow and spend. But both parties want to spend. Neither party has any interest in balancing a budget. Neither party has any interest in having a budget that is not in the deficits. Neither party has any interest in stopping the flood of government assistance to lazy, dishonest thieves who choose to live off of the hard work of honest Americans. They all want the government help. I must just say, just to touch on the coronavirus situation. Fear and panic is the name of the game. Christians and patriots are as guilty as anyone else. When we succumb to fear and panic, and we foment fear and panic in our sphere of influence, all we are doing is assisting the growth of big government over our lives. That's all we're doing. Fear and panic resulting in a willingness to accept more and more government control over our lives. The virus started in China. But the U.S. is the largest depository of biological weapons in the world. I'll just say this at this point, that if, capital letters, if, there is ever a global conspiracy, not just about the coronavirus, but about anything else, if there is ever a global conspiracy, you can take it to the bank that the CIA, MI6, and the Israeli Mossad are behind it. You can take it to the bank. Trump just signed an $8.3 billion emergency aid. Where are you going to get $8.3 billion from, Mr. Trump? You're going to borrow it. You're going to put us further in debt. We don't have $8 billion to do anything with. You're going to put us in debt. You're putting us deeper and deeper and deeper in debt. Emergency aid package to fight the virus. Okay. Ask yourself, who's getting the money? Who's getting the money? The giant pharmaceutical companies. State and local politicians who can use that money to bribe people to vote for them. State and local politicians, business leaders, the CDC, and if you don't know this already, then I guess this is a newsflash. Most of you probably already know this. The Center for Disease Control is nothing more than a government lobby group for Big Pharma. That's all it is. That's all it is. CDC doesn't care about you, doesn't care about me. All it cares about is Big Pharma getting big bucks from your taxes. That's all it cares about. And the international bankers. I cannot take time to go into that in this message. You can do a little research. What's the old saying? Follow the money. This is just another bailout for the international bankers. This economy is in a fabricated, manufactured, phony bubble. None of it is real. The feds have been pouring trillions of dollars into the stock markets over the last 6 months or more. If the economy is so great, Mr. Trump, why do the feds have to put trillions of dollars into the stock market to keep it afloat? Why? Why are the American people working two and three jobs just to make ends meet? I mean, the honest people who aren't living off the government. It's a phony bubble economy that they keep propping up by borrowing more money that they don't have and putting more cash into the markets and into the economy to try and stabilize the country from going bankrupt. And the only reason that America has not already filed bankruptcy, I don't mean in the technical sense, I mean in the practical sense, is because we are the world's reserve currency. That is the only thing keeping the American dollar solvent. We are the world's reserve currency. The international bankers, big business, politicians, pharmaceutical companies, they're the ones getting the money. Of the $8.3 billion, listen to this. This will grab you. $7.8 billion of the $8.3 is earmarked as, I'm not making it up, quoting their own documents, discretionary appropriations. Discretionary appropriations. You know what that means. It means they can spend that on anything they want to spend it on. No strings attached. You and I will never know where that $7.8 billion went. We'll never know. They will never tell us. So far, 12 Americans have died from the disease. By the way, globally, 98% of the people who have been infected by coronavirus have recovered. Did you hear that? 98% of all the people who have contracted coronavirus have recovered from the virus. They did not die. 98%. But did you know that since last September, October, November, December, January, February, March, 6 months. Since September, over 30 million Americans have contracted the flu. 10% of the population of this country has been infected by the flu virus over the last 6 months. And 18,000 have died from the flu in the last 6 months. 18,000 Americans have died from the flu over the last 6 months, 30 million have been infected over the last 6 months. Why is no one panicked over the flu? Why is there no talk of quarantine over the flu? Over 50,000 people die every year from the flu virus. 50,000 people. No panic, no alarm. Where is the $8.3 billion emergency aid package to fight the flu? You know the reason, because Americans are desensitized to the flu virus. It's been around a long time. We've been dealing with the flu virus for many years. You and I both know that the people who normally succumb to the flu virus or to any virus similar are people who are already in a sickened condition, who are weak in their immune system, people that have other diseases already in their body. They've been fighting it. Their body's weak. Their immune system is down. And when the flu comes, it's the straw that broke the camel's back, and they pass away from it. Healthy people normally do not succumb to the flu virus, and healthy people are not going to succumb to the coronavirus for the most part. It is always the weak and the frail and the sick that are prone to succumb to these kind of physical conditions. But we're desensitized to the flu. And as such, we're not scared by it. But this is new. It's not really new. It's been around for decades, by the way. It's not new. The medical community knows that they knew about this at least going back to the 1980s. I've read medical journals that talk about that they've known about this virus since the 1980s. It's not new, but it's new as far as the sensational broadcast of the people. It's new, and as such can scare the American people into accepting forced quarantines, small business reductions, supply shortages, forced vaccination, and more government in general. And that's the goal. The goal is to scare the American people into accepting bigger and bigger government over their lives. We already know that flying a commercial airliner, let me say it another way. We already know that commercial airliners are incubators for infection, for people who are vulnerable to it. We already know that. We already know that traveling abroad can be risky to one's health. We already know that. Depending on the part of the world you go to, depending upon the conditions of that society that you are visiting, you could be vulnerable to diseases that you probably would not be vulnerable to if you stayed in the United States. We already know that. We already know that large cities are ripe for all kinds of risks. Crime, violence, riots. Big cities, especially a couple dozen of them, are prime nuclear targets. I was interviewed this week by Religion News Service. Well, actually, I was interviewed a week or so ago, and the report came out this week. And they were asking me about our move to Montana. James Wesley Walls also had a part of that article. It's a good article. They were very fair. They weren't slanted in any way. And I expressed to them some of my reasoning and some of the things that we thought over and prayed over over 10 years ago when we came here. And she said, well, what about the coronavirus? I said, the truth be told, America has far more to fear from a potential nuclear exchange than we do the coronavirus. There are at least 24 large metropolitan areas that are already known to be prime targets of a nuclear attack. If you live in a big city, and some people have no choice, I suppose. That's your business between you and God, you and your family. But if you live in a large metropolitan area, you knowingly accept the risk that there is much more crime than there is in a more rural, smaller community. There is much more violence. There are the potential of riots at any time, that your community may be a target for a nuclear attack. Those are facts that are endemic for big metropolitan areas. What's tragic is that so many people that live in these areas are not even thinking about those risks. And when something happens, they act all surprised and shocked. We saw it in Los Angeles in the 90s. We saw it in New Orleans in 2005. What happens with emergency situations in large areas? Just to help you, when in LA it was the riots that broke out, uncontrolled, uncontained. In New Orleans, it was Hurricane Katrina. Doesn't matter what the cause of the disaster or the emergency is, whether it's natural, man-made, doesn't matter. The result's the same. What law enforcement is trained to do, and we saw this up close and personal, and there's some of the guys that are in this service today that saw this themselves, because when Katrina came through New Orleans and Mississippi, and the utter destruction and devastation that it inflicted upon those areas, we that were close by, we lived in the panhandle of Florida, just a few miles away, we, along with many other churches and organizations, participated in trying to provide emergency aid and assistance to those people. Water, food, clothing, medical supplies, etc. We packed up trucks full of these emergency supplies. And some of the men volunteered their time, and they drove the things. We concentrated more on Mississippi because everybody else seemed to be focused on New Orleans, and Mississippi was kind of left out of the limelight. So we did a lot in Mississippi, but we also went into New Orleans. I remember trying to get the supplies into New Orleans. Law enforcement, including the National Guard and other military units, surrounded the city, put an armed perimeter around the city, and would not let anybody in or out. They did not go in to try and help those people that were trapped inside. Gangs ruled the city of New Orleans for a week, 10 days or more. There was no law in New Orleans. Many of the police officers, for fear of their lives, joined the gangs in plundering the citizens of New Orleans. The atrocities and the violence committed in that place for that couple of week period of time is something out of a war zone. It was inhuman what happened inside that city. And there was no government assistance whatsoever available to those people. They set up that military perimeter. They would not let anybody in. They would not let anybody out. I remember watching the interstate systems leading into New Orleans backed up for miles and miles and miles with supply trucks, some of them 18-wheelers. Some of them pickup trucks, every truck size imaginable. They were all filled with medical supplies, food, water, etc. And they were sitting dead on the interstate. They could not get in. They did the same thing in Los Angeles in the 1990s. When the riots broke out, they surrounded the inner city and they would not let anybody in. They would not let anybody out. If you think that in a real emergency in these big cities that you're going to be able to call 911 and get help, you don't have a clue where you are living and what is happening in that place. If you live in a big city, you have to be willing to accept those risks. You're living with those risks every single day. Now, I hope you haven't lost my train of thought. I'm contrasting the results of the last 125 years of church growth in modern America with the 125 years of Christian growth in colonial America. Are you with me? You remember what the result was in colonial America after 125 years of great awakening, spiritual renewal. What's happened with all of the great church growth? Mega churches, TV preachers, TV evangelists, radio preachers, Christian colleges, Christian schools, 300,000 evangelical churches. What's happened to America? I've told you. And we know it. Now I want you to consider this. I found this a few days ago. A travel site. It's a large travel organization. They specialize in helping people with their travel plans, giving all kinds of information. It's a constant supply of information coming out from this organization relative to people who travel, okay? So this organization this week listed the top 10 most sinful states. That's their title, not mine. That's their title. Top 10 most sinful states. Are you ready?
Yes, sir.
Here they are. Here are the top 10 most sinful states in America. Number 10, Mississippi. It's rated number 1 for laziest. It's rated number 4 for greediest. Number 9, South Carolina. Ranked near the top in anger, hatred, and jealousy. There are more evangelical Christians per person in South Carolina than in any other state in the country. Number 9, most sinful state. Number 8, Illinois. It ranks 7 for vanity, 13th for anger and hatred. Number 7, Louisiana. Number 2 for anger, hatred, excesses, and vices. Number 6, Tennessee. Number 3 for anger and hatred. Number 8 for excesses, vices, and lust. Number 5, Georgia. Number 1 for jealousy. Number 6 for lust. Number 4, California. Number 2 for lust and vanity. Third most sinful state in America, Florida. Number 2 for jealousy. Number 3 for vanity. Number 2 most sinful state in America, Texas. Number 1 for lust. And number 1 probably doesn't surprise you, most sinful state in America, Nevada, the gambling and prostitution capital of America. Those are the 10 most sinful states, according to this travel organization. Did you notice something? 7 of the 10 most sinful states are in the Bible Belt. They are in the Bible Belt, which means those states have more churches, evangelical churches. They have more mega churches. They have more radio preachers, more television preachers, more Christian schools and colleges. You go to Texas, go to Florida, you will find mega churches in just about every town of any size. Churches on every corner. In the community from which we came in Florida, and it's been 10 years, so my stats on memory might be a little faded. If I remember correctly, in the metro area of the community in which I live, there were over 200 Baptist churches alone. Just Baptist churches. That doesn't include Charismatics or Pentecostals or Church of God or Assembly of God. Doesn't include Lutherans or Presbyterians or Catholic. There are over 200 Baptist churches in that community. And that community was a community of about 350,000 people. What good are all of these churches doing America? What good are all these mega churches doing America? Where is the fruit of 125 years of massive church growth in this country? Where's the fruit? We saw the fruit in colonial America. We're seeing no fruit today. The churches are just as ungodly and sinful as any other organization on the whole. Jesus said, "Ye are the salt of the earth. But if the salt have lost his savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is henceforth good for nothing." Jesus' words, not mine. Good for nothing, but to be cast out and trodden under the foot of men. The difference between the 125 years in colonial America and the last 125 years of modern America is that preachers have lost their salt. They've lost their salt. That's the difference. That's the only difference. There's not a difference in numbers, because we've got greater numbers now than ever. It's not a difference in congregations. We've got more congregations and bigger congregations than ever. It's not a difference in saturation. We've got more saturation now than ever when you include the airwaves and the broadcast, radio, television, internet, all these things. It's not a difference in any of that. There's only one difference. Colonial preachers had salt, and the modern preachers do not. They've lost their salt. And Jesus said, not Chuck Baldwin, Jesus said, they are good for nothing. That's what Jesus said. The messages today are all sugar. Pastors have taught their people to look to government for the solutions to our problems instead of looking to God. The answer to America's ills is not Donald Trump or the Republican Party. The answer to America's ills is God and his ministers in the pulpits of righteousness. But these pastors are not teaching their people to look to God or truth. They're teaching their people to look to government. Look to the White House. I've got a message: looking for hope in all the wrong places. Looking for hope in all the wrong places. When you're looking for hope in Donald Trump, you're looking in all the wrong places. When you're looking for hope in the Republican Party, you're looking all in the wrong places. When you're looking for hope in Washington, D.C., you're looking for hope in all the wrong places. The hope is not in politics at all. The only thing that's on Christians' minds today is the presidential election. That's all they want to talk about. In their minds, if Donald Trump doesn't get reelected, there is no hope for America. I'm not making it up. You've talked to these people. You know what I'm talking about. There is no hope for America. There is no future for America. All is lost in America. If Donald Trump is not reelected, we have no hope. That's what they believe. That's what they think. And that's how they act. Can you imagine a generation of Christians placing the entire hope for their future, their children, their grandchildren, our freedom, everything about our country's survival in the hands of an amoral, immoral, misogynist, bullying, dishonest, lying, pathological liar, adulterer, serial adulterer. This is the man that Christians, and I was trying to say Christians and preachers at the same time. That Christians and preachers have placed their hope in. That's not an indictment against Mr. Trump. That's an indictment against every pastor and every Christian in this country who is looking to Mr. Trump for their future hope. That's the indictment. This was not the message of colonial pulpits. Some of you bought a book that I made available not too long ago with some of the preaching of colonial America. You won't read those kind of sermons in those books. You don't see men in colonial America preaching that their hope was in a president, any president, or a Congress, or a political institution. They preached salty messages. They gave people truth. They gave people the gospel. They gave people biblical natural law principles. They gave people courage. They gave people hope. They gave people love. They preached salty sermons. Plus, and I'll just say this in passing, it cannot be overlooked that in the 1700s, there was no Zionist state of Israel that colonial Christians were trying to bless. No Zionist state of Israel that they were trying to bless didn't exist. Ask yourself, where is all this blessing that America should be receiving for blessing Israel for the last 70 plus years? Where's all the blessing? I'll bless them. Oh, that's Israel. God will bless it. Where's the blessing, folks? In every discernible category of social, spiritual, moral, ethical behavior and conduct, we are worse off today than we were in 1948. Where's the blessing? It is the job of preachers, not politicians, to be the salt that preserves polite society. If Christians truly want a solution for America's ills, they will seek pastors who will deliver the salty sermons that God requires of them and seek to follow the truth in those salty sermons in their own lives. If people that call themselves Christians really want to save America, they'll get out of the saltless, sugar-coated churches, and they'll get into the real meat and men of God who are preaching the salty messages that God would have them, and they would adhere themselves to those messages, and they would put their hearts into those messages. They would become the followers of the truth contained in those messages, and the Christians would be the salt, the preservative in society that God intended that we be. Because we have saltless pulpits and sugar churches, the churches of America, for the most part, have lost the respect of the vast majority of the unchurched community. That is not smoke. That is fact. You can read every scientific survey that you want. They all say the same thing. Churches are less important today than ever in the minds of the average American person. Church attendance on the whole is dropping every year. 4,000 evangelical churches close their doors every single year in this country. Atheism and agnosticism, unbelief, infidelity is growing in greater percentages than at any time in American history. We now have, imagine, in Ben Franklin's time, he said you could live to a ripe old age and never meet an atheist. And I guarantee you, every college freshman that goes to any secular college or university is going to meet an atheist in the classroom the very first semester that they attend school. Atheism, agnosticism, infidelity is at a higher percentage than any time in America's history, and the chart is going like this. Next year, it'll be more than this year. The year after that, it'll be more than the next year. Americans are fed up with church. They're fed up with preachers. They're fed up with hypocritical Christians. They're fed up with gossip and slander and backbiting. They're fed up with the carnality. They're fed up with all of the hypocrisy that goes on in the churches. They are tired of it, and they are out of it. And we can sit back in our haughtiness and we can blame the ungodliness of these people who dare, how dare they not want to come to my church? Or we can get honest with God and realize that we have lost the salt that God placed in us as a body. And as a result, we are not preserving the decay and the deterioration of society. That's what salt does. It preserves. It doesn't allow the putrefaction to invade the meat. Keeps it pure and clean. Without salt, spoilage and decay comes quickly. We've lost our salt. And our society is decadent as a result. There are thousands of good men across America that are preaching the salty messages. There really are. Don't want you to be ignorant of this. There are thousands of good truth-telling pastors across America, but they are being overshadowed by the prosperity gospel, faith-healing, feel-good, emotion-driven, Zionist-loving megachurches that have poisoned Christian fruit and influence and have sucked the salt right out of the country. And Christians go to these churches for the entertainment value and the feel-good value, and the self-importance value. I can be somebody of importance over there. I can have a position. I can have power. I can have authority. I can fuel my ego and my pride, and I can be a big shot in that congregation. And the so-called pastors love people like that because it brings in the crowds and the money. And they get to take their months-long paid vacations every year. And they get to go to the golf course 3 or 4 times a week. And they get to socialize with the money people in the community. And they're invited to the clubs and the social programs. And they're given notoriety. They love it. The proud feeding the proud. The greedy feeding the greedy. The base feeding the base. All in the name of God. it is thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and trodden under the foot of man, said Jesus. America is being trodden under the foot of men, under the foot of corrupt politicians, pornographers, mind-poisoning entertainers, war merchants, women exploiters, and religious charlatans. And the blame lies with the American pulpit and with the people in the pew who tolerate and support these saltless pulpits. If you really want to do something for America as a Christian, and you're serious about serving God, you will leave these saltless, sugar-coated churches. Leave! The congregation you go to, where there's a salty preacher in the pulpit, might be a lot smaller than what you're used to. Most of the congregations in colonial America were under 100. If there was a church that had over 100 in it on any given Sunday, at that era in our history, that was a large congregation. They might not have the programs that you think you got to have. But you'll be fed truth by a man of God with conviction and iron in his backbone, and is willing to tell you and your family the truth of God. And if you will follow that man of God and listen to the truth that he gives you, your children and your family will be much better off than they are in that entertainment-oriented, recreation-oriented, glorified social club that you're in right now. That will have no redeeming value whatsoever in your kids' lives. Most of these people that have rejected the church were raised in church. But I don't want to end negatively, because I'm not discouraged and I'm not pessimistic. Because I believe with all my heart that God is at work. Amen. Great Reformation threw off the tyranny of Romanism, led to the Great Awakenings in colonial America, which led to the creation of this greatest free nation, at least at one time, that ever existed. In the establishment of a Christian society throughout the country. The same God that threw off the bondage of Romanism under Wycliffe and Tyndale and Calvin and Luther and Zwingli and those other great men, I believe, is already beginning another reformation whereby the tyranny of Zionism will likewise be broken free, and the church will be liberated once again from the bondage of religious tyranny. It's already started. My experience and your experience, and those of you online, we are not isolated examples. We are part of something that God is doing that is much bigger than we can ever see. I told Stephen and Yana in the interview this week, they were talking about being discouraged and all the opposition that they're getting and all the opposition that we get. You mark it down. The devil is not only opposing us from the outside, he will try to plant people in this fellowship that will attack us from inside. Yeah. You be aware of that. Yeah. And I told Stephen Yana, I'm saying it to all of you, do not be discouraged, because God is liberating the hearts and the minds of millions and millions of Christian people throughout not just America, but around the world. This is a move of God. It's not a movement of men. What would cause us to do what we did 10 years ago? That cannot be explained in natural terms. There was something supernatural about that. Everything about Liberty Fellowship has been supernatural even before this entity came into existence. There was a supernatural, miraculous moving of God that caused this fellowship to be birthed and that has protected this fellowship through the onslaughts of the enemy over and over and over again. And we stand today stronger and more influential in the nation as a whole than we have ever been in our going on 10 years of existence. People are responding to this message in mass. When the Vice President of the United States gets up and says, as he did a couple of weeks ago, this administration officially recognizes anti-Zionism to be anti-Semitism. And we promise to root it out in all forms. That was a threat from the Vice President of the United States to every one of us who sees the Zionist state of Israel as a corrupt criminal body that it is. That was a threat. We will root you out in every form. That's what he said. Why would the Vice President of the United States feel compelled to make such a threat? Because that's what tyrants do when they lose the moral and the intellectual argument. When they lose the intellectual argument, when they lose the moral argument, when they realize that their lies are being seen through and that their phony facade is breaking down and people are beginning to recognize the error for what it is, they have no recourse but to resort to threats of violence. What that means? That means Mike Pence and Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo and Nikki Haley and all those other Christian Zionists in Washington, D.C. are scared that they are losing the battle. That's what it means. They can't debate us anymore. They can't argue it anymore. There is no more intelligence that is available to counter the revelation of truth that people have on this subject. And so they resort to threats of government force. That's the only thing tyrants know how to do. So they are really, we need to applaud them. You are all, Mr. Pence, God bless you. You are indeed a faithful, loyal, dedicated, true Zionist. Because that's what Zionists have been doing ever since they were created as a state in 1948. And you're behaving the same way. And so the president signs an executive order and says to all the all the secular state colleges and universities, if you have a professor or a student who criticizes either Israel or Zionism, you will lose all federal funding for your university. And that professor, if he doesn't stop, he or she doesn't stop criticizing Israel or Zionism or both, will need to be fired. 28 states, South Dakota just became the 28th state about 3 weeks ago. 28 states have anti-BDS laws, which violates the freedom of speech and the First Amendment, violates the freedom of commerce, trashes the First Amendment. It makes the American people, the citizens of South Dakota, Texas, Florida, all these other 28 states, it makes the citizens of those states, in essence, sign loyalty oaths to the state of Israel. That's what it does. Did I tell you about Dickinson, Texas, 2017, when Hurricane Harvey came through and the citizens were eligible for emergency aid, but before the city of Dickinson would release the funds to the American citizens, the citizens of the city of Dickinson, who needed the emergency assistance from Hurricane Harvey and were eligible for it, they had to sign a loyalty oath to Israel before they would receive the emergency funds. Can you imagine an American city refusing to release American funding in an emergency to American citizens unless those citizens signed a loyalty oath to a foreign government? That was a fact. It happened 2017. Governor Abbott of Texas said, when he received the Friend of Zion Award in Jerusalem, just like Trump and Pence. Who was the other guy? Bush. G.W. Bush and Trump both received the same award. He said, anyone who is an enemy of Israel is an enemy of Texas. Wow. I thought a governor took an oath to the Constitution of the United States. When did Governor Abbott take an oath to the state of Israel? And what does he have in mind for the enemies, the citizens of Texas, who want to engage in their First Amendment rights to boycott the state of Israel with goods and services in the way they spend or don't spend their money, and in their speech, whether they criticize or not a foreign government? What does he have in mind for those enemies, the citizens of Texas, who refuse to sign loyalty to the Israeli government? What does he have in mind for them, I wonder? He didn't say. Jail? Imprisonment? Torture? Death? What does he have in mind? Enemy. This is how influential Zionism is in this country. Benjamin Netanyahu got up on February 12th of this year and bragged and said that the Zionist State of Israel, has manipulated the state governments in the United States to be sure that they passed anti-BDS laws in their states. He bragged about it. And 28 states have done it. I pray to God, in this fellowship, I tell you, we will be in this fight if it ever comes to Montana. But the day comes that the Montana legislature takes up a bill to oppose its citizens from participating in BDS causes, we will be on the front lines of that protest and praying to God and doing everything to convince our legislators that that is one of the most un-American bills that could ever be passed in a state legislature, to demand that a state, a group of people, Americans living in a state collectively under the flag of the state of Montana, would be required to swear loyalty to a foreign government, in my opinion, is treason. Before God destroyed the stranglehold, I'll close. Before God destroyed the stranglehold of Talmudic Phariseeism, which is modern Zionism, he sent oracles to Jerusalem to warn Christians to flee the city. I talked with Stephen and Yana about that on our interview, and I go into this at length in my message, the destruction of Jerusalem. Between 1 million and 2 million people died in that horrific siege. It's the worst military siege in the annals of military history. Even with all of the modern warfare implements of war that we have, the military weaponry that we've invented over the centuries, notwithstanding, it's still today the worst military siege in human history. And there wasn't a single Christian who died in that siege. If you watched the destruction of Jerusalem, you heard me explain all this. Remember, the church began on the day of Pentecost, 3,000 saved, baptized, added to the church. Within a short period of time, church history tells us, in the city of Jerusalem, there were 100,000 Christians, at least 100,000 Christians in the city of Jerusalem alone. Think about it. Think about all those thousands and thousands of Christians. Many of them fled because of persecution, no doubt. But not all. The apostles were still there, most of them. The church was still there. Thousands of them were still there. When you read the book of Acts, the story of the life of the apostle Paul and his missionary journeys and so forth, he was even leading the churches in other areas to give support to the suffering saints in Jerusalem. You remember those scriptures? The saints were there. The Christians were there. But by the time 68 AD rolled around, and the siege was just starting, a two-year siege, God sent oracles to the Christians in Jerusalem. Get out of this city. God is going to annihilate this city. Of course, the recalcitrant Jews, they paid no heed. But the Christians knew this was of God. And they left. And by the time the siege commenced in earnest and was fulfilled in 70 AD, 1 to 2 million people slaughtered, and not a single Christian among them. And those Christians went into the ends of the earth preaching the gospel of the new covenant, telling people that Jesus died for their sins. By grace through faith are ye saved. Trust Christ and Christ alone. And they evangelized the known world. And eventually that evangelization spread to all parts of Europe and then to America. And here we are. The great, 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 great grandchildren of those Christians in Jerusalem who heard the oracles of God and fled a doomed and damned city and went on to evangelize the world. Before God destroyed the stranglehold of Talmudic Phariseeism, he sent oracles to Jerusalem to warn Christians to flee. This they did. And God used them to bring the message of the new covenant and the doctrine of grace to the world. I believe God has sent and is sending oracles to the church today to warn them of his coming judgment upon this reincarnated Talmudic Phariseeism, which is nothing more than Judaic and Christian Zionism, and the exodus out of these spiritually tyrannous churches has already begun. The Reformation has already begun. The Exodus has already begun. 50 years from now, 75 years from now, people will look back on this period of church history. And they will see the godless Zionist movement for what it was. And they will have utter contempt for the so-called Christians who allowed themselves to be deceived and controlled by this evil doctrine. And they will have seen the oracles that God raised up to warn the church and to bring them out of this destruction and death. And there will be a new beginning of religious freedom, which has broken free from the tyranny as the Reformation broke the bondage of Romanism. So this Reformation will break the bondage of Zionism. It's already happening. I don't know what we will have to endure between now and then. When you hear people like the Vice President say what he said, we don't know what we may have to endure to get to that point. But I tell you what, the President, the Vice President, the Secretary of the State, the pastors of the biggest mega churches in America, all these people that are promoting the doctrinal garbage of Christian Zionism are no match for God and His truth. Rejoice, Liberty Fellowship. We are part of something that God is doing in this world today that is as exciting and is as thrilling as anything the reformers experienced in Europe, is as exciting and thrilling as anything that the great evangelical, colonial pastors, they didn't call themselves evangelicals in those days. Those great pastors of colonial America, what we are experiencing today is just as exciting, just as thrilling as anything they went through in their lifetime. We should be thankful and honored that God has chosen us to be part of this great deliverance that He is performing among his people today. God bless you. Let's stand. Let's stand for prayer.